You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. That's amazing. Last week I was talking about how Facebook made billions of dollars and got a $1 billion tax break, basically paid no taxes, got a $400 million tax refund, in fact, courtesy of you and me. And they did it through this, let's compensate our executives with stock options and make that tax deductible. And then those executives convert those stock options to pay. Well, it's not pay. They convert them to cash. They call it capital gains, and they pay a maximum 20% income tax with no Social Security taxes, et cetera. And, you know, basically this is one of those sweet little tax loopholes that if your corporation's big enough, and maybe this is just sour grapes, I don't know. You know, I've got a small corporation with a half a dozen employees, and my CPA tells me that there's no way that if I was to say, oh, look at this, my corporation has shown a profit, let's declare a dividend, I'm going to take my income as dividends and pay 20% income tax, he said I'd end up in jail. But Mark Zuckerberg, he can do that. This is called gaming the system. Chuck Gallagher's on the line. Well, this is the CEO and author of Second Chances, Transforming Adversity into Opportunity. His website, chuckgallagher.com. Chuck, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Fine. I am strongly of the opinion that things like this, or like the oil depletion allowance, which the oil companies say, well, you know, as we pump the oil out of the ground, this well becomes worth less and less, so we should get a tax break. And I say, you know, every year that I get older, I'm worth less and less, eventually I'll have to retire. So shouldn't I get an age depletion allowance? But no. Oil companies get it. I don't. You don't. Isn't it time for us as a people, the United States, the citizens of the United States, to say enough already of the buying of our politicians and buying of legislation by fat cats like the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil and, in this case, Facebook?
Well, here's the thing. You got a great question. Is it time to change? And the answer to that is probably yes. But at the same time, you have a small company, and so do I, Tom, but you can't fault Mark Zuckerberg for complying with and following what people in the United States Congress have written as the tax law and comply with the law of the land.
I'm not. I'm faulting, frankly, the five justices on the United States Supreme Court who say that money is the same thing as speech, and therefore Zuckerberg's corporation can spend millions of dollars hiring lawyers and hiring lobbyists. And frankly, it wasn't Facebook who came up with this. This has been in tax code since the Reagan administration. This was a major change, in fact, that was brought to you courtesy of a Republican Congress and Ronald Reagan's presidency, that prior to that time, you could not compensate executives with stock, and the maximum compensation for a CEO is $1 million, and beyond that, you could compensate them, but you couldn't deduct it. Yeah, the company, it was not deductible to the corporation, which, by the way, is still in place. I believe it's $2 million now. And Reagan changed the law during the Reagan administration. They changed the law to allow for this executive compensation via stock on this theory that executives should be operating on behalf of the stockholders, and which is turning capitalism on its head. I mean, historically, the executives operated on behalf of the corporation itself. What is good for the corporation, not what is good for the stockholders. And what is good for the corporation, by the way, typically was also what was best for the employees and for the customers. Now we've got customers being screwed routinely. We got employees being screwed routinely. The corporation itself is being screwed routinely. They're being bought, sold, destroyed, macerated, chewed up, spit out, sold overseas, whatever. And the only people who are making out like bandits are the stockholders, and in particular the stockholders at the top of the corporation. And it's just, I think this is a terrible, one of the many terrible Reaganomics experiments that has gone seriously wrong. Switzerland is holding a referendum to criminalize this, actual jail time for this kind of thing. And it looks like it's going to pass in Switzerland March 3rd or March 6th. They're going to hold a nationwide vote on CEO compensation. And, you know, of course, the loudest voices there are the CEOs of the three most well-compensated CEOs in all of Switzerland turn out to be Americans. And it's like, you know, Bloomberg reporting on this. Let me get the details here. These three Americans, the CEOs of Novartis, Roche, and Nestle, Dugan, Hogan, and Jimenez are the names of the guys. And they're saying, oh, wait a minute, you can't do this. And the Swiss are saying, we sure can't, just watch us.
Yeah, the one thing the Swiss are doing is at least recognizing the harsh reality that something has to change. And the question then comes back in our country is, at what point in time do the politicians decide that we need to operate in an practical economic way as opposed to looking at the shareholder as the end-all to end-all for the companies?
Well, I even go beyond that. I say I don't think that our politicians are operating in our interests. Frankly, they're not operating in the interests of corporations. They're operating in the interests of the people who are funding their campaigns. And this is the fatal flaw that has been brought to us, not just by Citizens United, but by Buckley versus Vallejo before that, and First National Bank versus Bilotti before Buckley was earlier than First National, and all the way back to arguably Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, 1886, and in fact, arguably back to Dartmouth v. United States in 1815, in this idea that corporations should have standing in court as persons and have some rights under the Bill of Rights. This is nuts.
Well, you know, it may be nuts, but it also is practically the law of the land. And the reality comes, you can either dramatically undo a lot of what's taken place, option one, which would take a whole lot.
You can do that with a simple amendment to the Constitution that simply says, A, corporations are not people, B, money is not speech, it's property.
Well, you could go that far, but, you know, the practicality is you're not going to get that. You'd have a whole lot better chance at looking and saying, you know what, if you look at the root cause of a lot of what's taking place, it is what you said earlier, that money is buying elections for people who want to be career politicians instead of politicians looking for what is in the best interest of the citizens that they represent.
Well, by and large, they have no choice. I mean, those few politicians who actually represent the best interest of their citizens are the lucky few, people like Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont, who live in states or districts that are small enough that they can engage in retail politics. Senator Sanders lives in a state with 600,000 people in it, and he's been in politics there for 20 years. He has probably met and shaken the hands of every single person in Vermont. I lived there for 10 years when he was my state representative, or my federal, you know, United States member of the House of Representatives, and attended a couple of events that he put on just because he was ubiquitous. I mean, Bernie was everywhere. He just won re-election to the Senate without spending $1 on television advertising, while his opponent spent $5 million. That's the power of having that luxury of being in a small district or a small state and being a good retail politician. But most politicians in the United States don't have that luxury, and they're facing, you know, multi-million dollar campaigns that are funded by big corporations or billionaires. And this is just wrong.
What Tom, would happen if they weren't career politicians?
Career politicians. Thomas Jefferson was a career politician. He did a damn good job. James Madison was a career politician. George Washington was a career politician. I want people who have institutional memory. I want people who have been around the block. If you get rid of the career politicians, if you term limit these people out, you know what's going to be the long-term institutional memory of this city here in Washington, D.C.? It's going to be the lobbyists.
Well, that very well may be true in terms of long-term memory, but the lobbyists don't get a vote.
No, they don't, but they will become the person to whom all the new politicians turn to say, how does this place work? What do I do? So, anyhow, that's my take on it. But Chuck Gallagher, an interesting conversation, chuckgallagher.com. You can check it out. Author of Second Chances, Transforming Adversity into Opportunity. Thanks, Chuck, for dropping by.
Take care, Tom.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. See, I think at the end of the day, the original sin is money. But it's President's Day, and I got to share some letters from Jefferson and Hamilton that are going to curl your hair. So back in the day when you couldn't quite buy a politician, first of all, There were no billionaires in America. In fact, there were no millionaires in the United States. The first millionaire came along in the 1790s in today's dollars. And a million ain't that much in today's dollars. Right? I mean, there's people who are millionaires just, you know, based on the value of their homes and whatnot, but particularly in some of our big cities. But the point is that Mr. Jefferson, this is Alexander Hamilton. Now, today's President's Day. I realize Hamilton was never a president, but he certainly was influential. The old cliche, and it's absolutely true, is that we all run around quoting Jefferson, but we live in Hamilton's country. That Hamilton had this vision for America. And Hamilton was the Secretary of the Treasury. Jefferson was the Secretary of State in the George Washington administration. Washington being the fourth president of the United States, the first to operate under the Constitution. So, arguably the first of the new United States. And Hamilton had this idea of empire, basically, this dynastic, manufacturing-based empire that used manufacturing and finance to build a great nation. And Jefferson thought that that was a dangerous road for us to go down. Now, he changed his mind once he became president in 1800, but this was back 4 years earlier, 6 years earlier, 8 years earlier, and, 7 years when these correspondences happened. When he and Hamilton were such enemies in the cabinet, and I just have to share some of the. I spent probably most of Saturday, 4 or 5 hours Saturday, reading these letters of Alexander Hamilton's to various people. I was, I'm working on a book right now, and I was looking for stuff that had to do with debt and trade. And but I found these incredible little pieces. Hamilton is writing, this is a letter to Colonel Edward Carrington, who was a personal friend of Hamilton's. It's dated May 26, 1792. So this was the second year, let's see, the George Washington administration. This was the third year. Whatever. Anyhow, 1792. And he says, Mr. Jefferson, with very little reserve, manifests his dislike of the funding system generally, calling into question the expediency of funding a debt at all. Jefferson would have been what today we call a modern monetary theorist. Some expressions, back to Hamilton, some expressions which he has dropped in my presence, parenthesis, sometimes without sufficient attention to delicacy, close parenthesis, will not permit me to doubt on this point representations which I have had from various respectable quarters. In other words, Jefferson's trash-talking him, not only to himself, but to other people. He says, in various conversations with foreigners as well as citizens, he has thrown censure on my principles of government and on my measures of administration. He did it in a style and manner which I felt as partaking of asperity and ill humor toward me. When any turn of things in the community has threatened either odium or embarrassment to me, he has not been able to suppress the satisfaction which it gave him. Hamilton's really PO'd with Jefferson because, you know, they had this battle. And it was a battle, by the way, that Hamilton ultimately won. He says, in respect to foreign politics, the views of these gentlemen, now he's talking about Jefferson and his protege, James Madison. In respect to foreign politics, who was also in the cabinet, he says, in respect to foreign politics, the views of these gentlemen are, in my judgment, equally unsound and dangerous. They have a womanish attachment to France and a womanish resentment against Great Britain. See, Hamilton himself did not have a problem with stooping to slapping him around. He says, Mr. Jefferson in France saw government only in the sight of its abuses. He drank freely of the French philosophy and religion, science and politics. He came from France in the moment of a fermentation. He's talking about leading up to the French Revolution, which he had a share in exciting. And he came here probably with too partial an idea of his own powers. He came electrified with attachment to France. And then he shifts to Mr. Madison, who he's also PO'd with. He says, Mr. Madison had always entertained an exalted opinion of the talents, knowledge, and virtues of Mr. Jefferson. The sentiment was probably reciprocal. A close correspondence subsisted between them during the time of Mr. Jefferson's absence from the country. A close intimacy arose upon his return. Mr. Jefferson was indiscreetly open in his approbation of Mr. Madison's principles. I say indiscreetly because a gentleman in the administration, now he's talking, see these guys, they're all in the cabinet. Says, I say indiscreetly because a gentleman in the administration in one department ought not to have taken sides against another in another department. The course of this business begot some degree of ill humor in Mr. Jefferson. I was aware of a systematic opposition to me on the part of these gentlemen. My subversion, I am now satisfied, has been long an object with them. I have feelings of personal mortification. So what was it he was mortified about? Well, it had to do with, in this case, this particular rant. Just a few months later, August 18, 1792, he wrote a letter to George Washington about this. And it was about the national debt. And it starts out, objection one. And so he's quoting his opponents. The public debt is greater than we can possibly pay before other causes of adding to it will occur. And this has been artificially created by adding together the whole amount of the debtor and creditor sides of the accounts. Answer. The public debt was produced by the late war. Whether it is greater than can be paid before new causes of adding to it will occur as a problem incapable of being solved but by experience. Now, I will explain what Hamilton was talking about, why the debt was a big deal at the founding of this country. Why, frankly, I think it's not a big deal right now. In fact, Hamilton at that time, he said, the debt of the United States compared with its present and growing abilities is really a very light one. At a little more than 15 million pounds sterling, about the annual expenditure of Great Britain. In other words, the debt of the United States was equal to the entire GDP of Great Britain, which was massively larger than the United States. And Hamilton says, oh, that's not so much debt. We can handle that. I'll tell you all about that right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's President's Day, or George Washington's birthday, actually. I guess it's the formal holiday. So let's talk about the George Washington administration. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Mark Sanford is on an apology tour. He wants to get back into politics. Go figure. Louise made the comment to me the other day. She always thought that his wife should have run against him. Maybe she will. I mean, his ex-wife now. He's got a new wife, the woman down in Argentina that he was shacking up with when he was walking the Appalachian Trail. And Minnie McCready is dead. I confess I'm not all that familiar with her and her music, but the provocative question over at the Daily Beast, did this high-profile rehab, actually, here's the, I don't want to misrepresent it. Let me just read you the exact quote. Country singer Minnie McCready has apparently committed suicide. The latest death of a star from VHS's Celebrity Rehab with Dr. Drew. And then the question, does rehab help or hurt? I don't think they're talking about rehab in, you know, generally, but the doing rehab in front of 50 million people on a reality show, that seems crazy. Something maybe Alexander Hamilton could have used. I was talking with a friend of mine over the weekend about Asperger's, and you know my theory that it's possible that both Hamilton and Jefferson were Aspies. They were both like super, super wonky, not particularly socially functional, and which I realize is drawing Asperger's with a huge broad brush. But Norm Legend wrote this brilliant book called, you know, Diagnosing Jefferson, which sensitized me to this issue. And you read these long letters. Anyhow, Jefferson was an absolute genius when it came to small d democracy. Just an absolute genius. But he, frankly, was not all that smart when it came to economics, in my opinion. And I think one of the demonstrations of that is that he died bankrupt. He was not even personally all that smart when it came to finances. Hamilton, on the other hand, was a savant when it came to economics. But his understanding of small-d democracy was, shall we say, marginal. At the Constitutional Convention, Hamilton stood up. He was one of the delegates from the state of New York. And he stood up and he said, as they were writing the Constitution, and they got into Article 2, which is the presidency, the executive branch, and he suggested that the president should be elected for life, just like the kings of Europe, and that the presidency would only change when the president died or voluntarily retired. He was literally laughed out of the chamber. He was hooted down. Now, Madison, you heard me reading earlier about his, shall we say, poor words for Mr. Madison and Mr. Jefferson. And but Madison, in his notes on the Constitution, made it rather clear that Mr. Hamilton was not well received. And Hamilton was so offended by the response at the Constitutional Convention to his suggestion that the president should be a bit like a king that he left. He went back to New York, said, screw this. And he didn't come back until the final 2 weeks of or thereabouts of the Constitutional Convention. Might have been a little longer than that. I'm telling you this story completely from memory, so I may be a little off on the dates. But the essence of it is quite solid, I assure you. So anyhow, here we have, after the Revolutionary War, we had a debt, public debt, that is government debt, that was, according to Alexander Hamilton, who knew this stuff, he was the Secretary of the Treasury, he invented our modern monetary system and our modern, or at least the American version, our modern mercantilist system, our trade policies. Our government at the time, well, as you will hear in a few minutes as I start quoting from Hamilton, was entirely funded by tariffs. And it really didn't do much. I mean, we maintained an army and that sort of thing. But, you know, during the George Washington administration, government was being run out of New York City, down near Wall Street. And so here we have this debt, 15 million pounds sterling. Again, quoting, this is Alexander Hamilton's official report as a cabinet officer to George Washington, dated July 29, 1792. And he said, you know, people are objecting. They're saying the public debt is greater than we can possibly pay before other causes of adding to it will occur. In other words, you know, the debt is overwhelming and we're going to add more to it and we got to do something. He says, well, the public debt was produced by the late war. It is not the fault of the present government that it exists. Now, just imagine. Barack Obama coming out and saying, you know, My detractors are saying that the public debt is greater than we can possibly bear, which is what they're saying. They're running around. I mean, you know, crazy old Mark McKinnon has a piece on Daily Beast about this. You know, just regurgitating the conventional wisdom that Alexander Hamilton was shooting down. Oh, our debt, you know, it's larger than our GDP. Well, Hamilton pointed out not only was our debt larger than our GDP, it was larger than Britain's GDP. And keep in mind, Britain was the largest, the greatest industrial power in the world and held that position as the largest and most powerful empire in the world until World War I. I mean, long after Hamilton and Jefferson were dead and George Washington. So today, George Washington's birthday, this was Hamilton's letter to George Washington. He said the public debt was produced by the late war. See, this is what Obama could say. You know, yeah, okay, you want to scream about the debt? Talk to George Bush. He had this war in Afghanistan, this war in Iraq, you know, plus Medicare Part D, plus a recession. Anyhow, he said, Hamilton says, it is not the fault of the present government that exists unless it can be proved that public morality and policy do not require of a government an honest provision for its debts. Well, that can't be proved, although that was part of the debate at the time. Because we had, you know, this debt was, you know, basically IOUs, bonds. And the debate was, should we pay off the bonds at par value, at their full value, or should we... And the other thing was, there'd been this enormous amount of speculation. A lot of these soldiers who had fought in the Revolutionary War had been paid in these with this debt, and the debt was used as money. But then, as the Articles of Confederacy were not working out all that well, the value of that debt started to collapse because there was this assumption that the federal government would never be able to pay it off. There was no mechanism for generating revenue. This is one of the reasons why they needed a constitution. And so as the new government came in, one of the first questions before the George Washington administration is, what do we do about the debt left over from the Revolutionary War a decade earlier? It's a debt that, to quote Alexander Hamilton, the debt of the United States compared with the present and growing abilities is really a very light one. It is little more than 15 million of pounds sterling, about the annual expenditure of Great Britain. So our debt was massively larger proportionally than our debt was than our debt is today. But Hamilton's saying, it's not that big a deal. He said, if the policy of the country be prudent, cautious, and neutral toward foreign nations, there's a rational probability that war may be avoided long enough to wipe off the debt. We can pay it off. He said, those who... And then he made this amazing point. He said that the people, Alexander Hamilton said to George Washington and to the rest of the cabinet members and to the nation, frankly, this is a public document, that the people who were running around saying that there was no way that the Washington administration could pay off the federal debt were risking the solvency of the United States. They were threatening the future of our nation, the deficit hawks. Because what they would do, because in order to pay off the debt, you had to maintain the debt for a while as we paid it off. In order to maintain it, we had to continuously be selling new debt instruments, new bonds, as old bonds were being redeemed. In order to sell new bonds, people had to have trust in the government, faith and confidence that the government would pay its debts. And if people didn't have faith that the government would pay its debts, then what would happen to us in 1792 would be like what's happening right now to Greece. The government would have to start paying 15, 20, 25% interest on it, on the money that it's borrowing, because, you know, it's called the risk premium. People aren't sure they're going to get their money back. So Hamilton basically says that people like Mark McKinnon and John Boehner and Paul Ryan, he said, those who clamor are likely to be the principal causes of protracting the existence of the debt. Because, you know, for this reason, I mean, he lays it all out here, but it takes him maybe 15 paragraphs to say it. And if I read it all, your eyes would glaze over because it's written, you know, in 18th century verbiage. But the bottom line is the value of our currency, the value of our debt, the value of our nation was perceptual. If people believed that we would pay our debts, then we could borrow at a very low interest rate and we could maintain our debt and we could slowly pay off our debt through the use of tariffs on imported goods. If, on the other hand, the people who are running around with their hair on fire screaming about the fact that we were 15 million pounds sterling in debt, if they people start paying attention to them and thinking, well, maybe the government can't pay off their debt, then we'd have a really serious problem.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It is almost exactly the situation that the Republicans are trying to create by screaming about the debt ceiling. It's almost identical. Welcome back, Dennis. Before the hour, you know, his objection number two, the accumulation of debt has taken forever out of our power, those easy resources of revenue. Well, you know, I'm going to carry this over throughout the rest of the next 2 hours here. I'm going to continue to share with little bits of Hamilton and George Washington and Thomas Jefferson with you as we continue through our program. But let me just say, what is going on right now, the people who are trashing this country right now, by saying that we should default on our obligations, whether it's the sequester, we should default on contracts that we've made, the social contract to our people, or contracts to defense contractors. And I'm no fan of defense contractors, but hey, If you've committed to something, you've committed to something. Those Republicans who are saying that we should default, or, you know, or we should just, you know, cut, are the same people that Alexander Hamilton was railing against as being fundamentally un-American back in 1792, who were screaming about the debt, and Hamilton was saying, don't worry, we'll take care of this. We got this. Saul in North Dartmouth, Mass. Hey, Saul, what's on your mind today? You want to talk about Ben Franklin?
Thank you, Tom. Yes. Even during the Revolution, as we were borrowing money from the French, they were already having discussions about paying off the debt to the French for running the Revolution. And one of my favorite quotes that I've been using ever since we went into the recession and dealing with the debt and deficit is that Ben Franklin wrote one time that it is absurd to profess to be lovers of liberty people ought to do more for themselves, for it is absurd to profess to be lovers of liberty whilst begrudging the payment of it. And I think that that quote from Ben Franklin speaks volume as to where we are today. We don't mind going to war. We don't mind conducting two wars, three wars. But at the same time, nobody wants to pay for it.
Right.
Nobody.
And this was a tradition. You know, Dick Cheney famously said, Ronald Reagan taught us that deficits don't matter. This is a tradition that was started during the Reagan administration of running up debt without any intention of ever paying for it. Reagan tripled the national debt, and in fact, a little more than tripled the national debt. And you know, with this huge Star Wars program and massive military buildup and increasing social spending as well. I mean, basically, Reagan just spent money on anything he could see and thought that was just fine. And then George Herbert Walker Bush continued the process and added another $1 trillion to our debt. And then, as soon as Bill Clinton came into office, the Republicans all of a sudden noticed the debt. This was Jude Winiski's plan back in 1976. He laid it out. And Republicans started screaming about the debt. So Clinton did something about it. But, the net of it is that, yeah, I think, you know, it's a patriotic thing to say, okay, let's deal with this and deal with it appropriately. The question is, how do we deal with it and deal with it appropriately? And that's a big one. Saul, thank you for the call. Thought-provoking. Tony in Stafford, Virginia. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Tom. I keep hearing about the sequester thing going on lately, and the way I look at it, they're just trying to put the fear of God in people through this thing.
Sure.
They have three ways to handle it. One, they can let it go the way it's what it's going to happen. Two, they can kick it down the road to next year, maybe even 2113. Or three, they can go ahead and cancel the darn thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the main reason it was put in there was, one, it was a carrot on a stick for the super committee to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And John Boehner, he was looking to save face because of what he was doing, trying to use the debt ceiling as a hostage.
Yeah, well, and here's what John Boehner said, by the way, when he successfully negotiated the sequester with President Obama and the Democrats. Here's what he said.
And when you look at this final agreement that we came to with the White House, you know, I got 98% of what I wanted. I'm pretty happy.
So I don't understand why the Republicans are running around calling this the Obama sequester.
Yeah, and also it gave the Tea Party members of Congress something to go back home with.
Right.
And
it was a scalp.
People, well, if this fails, we're going to get these cuts anyway.
Right.
And now they're talking about defense. Out of a budget that's almost $1 trillion itself, I think they can find $50 billion.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, this is like government this is like zombie government. It's like government is kind of lurching around, you know, like Frankenstein's monster, just kind of lurching from thing to thing, because the Republicans have no core operating principles other than keeping taxes low for rich people and keeping huge tax breaks and subsidies in place for large corporations that fund them. And the Democrats, are way too timid and too often shoot themselves in the foot. And B, have been politically outmaneuvered by the Republicans, particularly in the media, which is largely owned by Republicans. So, good point, Tony. Michael in Chesterton, Indiana. Hey, Michael, you want to talk about inflation and bond yields?
Hi, I just wanted to add that with the bond yield lower or roughly equal to the point of inflation as it is right now,
right. You're
virtually borrowing for free.
That's
plus,
correct.
With the unemployment so high, when you do borrow, your chances of causing inflation are next to nothing.
That's correct.
Those two things occurring at the same time in history are pretty unique. So this is...
Well, they're not all that unique. It's not unlike what happened in 1933. 32, 33, 30, 31, 32, 33. You had very, very low bond yields, and you not only had no inflation, you had deflation. The government could borrow very cheap, and in fact, that's what FDR did, and you could use that to put people back to work. We should be putting people back to work. We should be borrowing, the federal government should be borrowing money or printing, coining money if it wants to coin trillion-dollar coins. Fine with me. I don't care. It's just fine. And using that money to put people back to work. And by putting people to work, you move them out of the category of taking money from the government in the form of the social safety net stuff like Medicare and unemployment benefits and whatnot, food stamps, and move them into the category of putting things into government, into the category of becoming taxpayers. The government should be the employer of last resort. This was a founding principle of the New Deal. FDR demonstrated that it worked. And in fact, if you can take employment down to zero, as happened during World War II, you know, functional unemployment down to zero, then the economy really gets strong. And then, you know, at that point, the government can back off and say, okay, we're not going to spend all that much. We're just going to take the tax revenue from all these people who are working now, and we don't have to spend out because we don't have anybody on food stamps anymore. And in fact, there's so much left over that we can send an entire generation to college, which is what they did with the GI Bill in the 1950s. So, the late 40s and through the 50s and into the early 60s. So, Michael, thank you for the call. Excellent. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jay Angoff is on the line with us. He's a partner with Marion Scalet. Am I saying that right, PLCC?
No, close. It's Marion Scalet.
Marion Scalet. Thank you very much, Jay. And a former director of the Office of Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight at DHS, appointed by HHS Secretary... at the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, appointed by HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, and the website findjustice.org. And Jay, you are quite familiar with these health exchanges that are part of Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. And if my reading is correct, last Friday was the deadline for individual states to either set up their own exchanges or tell the federal government to come in and take it over for them, do the job for them. Do I have that right?
Yes, exactly right.
Okay, and so what happened on Friday?
Well, on Friday, a few states said that they would be doing partnership exchanges with the federal government, and that means that the federal government will be responsible for certain functions and the states for others, although the federal government will be running the exchanges in the majority of states. About 17 will be running the exchanges themselves, and then in the rest of the states, there'll be a partnership between the federal government and the state. But the important thing is that in all states, regardless of whether the federal government runs it or the state runs it or there's a combination of both, there are going to be these exchanges, which means that people are going to be able to go to the Internet. They're going to be able to punch in the answers to four different questions, which are where you live, your zip code, basically, your age, the type of coverage you want, and whether you smoke or not. That's also a rating factor. But when you punch in the answers to those questions, you will get the prices charged by all the insurance companies doing business through the exchange in that state, and you'll be able to compare the prices of policies that are of similar value. So for the first time, people will actually be able to make apples-to-apples comparisons of insurance policies, and that will facilitate price competition and should drive down rates.
That's remarkable. It's also interesting that while insurance companies can no longer discriminate based on prior conditions, they can't say if you ever had cancer or if you ever had hepatitis or if you ever had, fill in the blank, They can say, do you smoke? That being addicted to nicotine is a discriminatable offense, as it were.
Yeah, and that's an interesting issue, and that's an issue on which I guess reasonable people can disagree, but both the health advocacy groups and the insurance industry were in favor of allowing companies to charge people more based on smoking.
Sure.
Insurance companies, obviously, for risk-related reasons. People who smoke have a much higher risk of illness, of costing insurance companies money, so they want to be able to charge people who smoke more. And then health advocacy groups also think that's a good thing. It's a good thing for the health status of the country. So
it might be the thing that'll push some smokers over the edge and cause them to say, okay, enough already.
Exactly.
But now, Jay,
one more reason not to smoke.
Right, there you go. As if we need it anymore. Jay, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that by and large, and there may be a few exceptions to this, but by and large, the states that have opted to create their own in-state insurance exchanges are states that are run, basically blue states run by Democratic administrations. And the states that have chosen to say to the federal government, you guys run it, have been largely red states or even blue states that are run by Republican governors and Republican legislatures. Do I have that right?
Yeah, and that's ironic, isn't it?
Well, I think it's bizarre because the whole Republican talking point is states' rights, you know, that the states should be able to do things. And so here you have Obama saying, cool, you want to do it? Do it. Set it up. Run it yourself. And these Republican governors are saying, no, we're not going to play. After all, this is your game.
Well, you're absolutely right. It is. I think I used the word ironic. You said bizarre. I think they're both apt. What you've got is Republican governors, very conservative, very anti-Obamacare and anti-Obama governors saying, welcome federal government. They're
right.
Inviting the federal government in. They want the federal government to run the exchange. And, of course, that's completely inconsistent with all the rhetoric that we hear from these governors. So it doesn't make sense.
What impact is that going to have on those states? Is that going to diminish? I mean, is there an incentive to states running their own exchanges? Does it improve the quality of the product ultimately that their citizens get? Or
not necessarily. That's a great question, and the answer is not necessarily. But to the question whether there's an advantage for states in running their own exchanges, the answer to that is very definitely yes. The advantage for states is that they get money if they run their own exchanges. There is a program, there's a provision of the Affordable Care Act, which authorizes the Department of Health and Human Services to make grants to states that run their own exchanges to pay the cost of running their exchanges.
Right.
And so that is that's a tremendous benefit to states. But some of them, and in a way, in a perverse way, maybe we should give some of these governors credit for it. Some of these governors have said, no, we don't want the money. Some governors have actually given back the money.
Mm-hmm.
But again, all this stuff is sort of inside the beltway. As far as the individual is concerned, the individual, wherever he or she lives, whatever state, there will be an exchange, and in each state, people will be able to go to the internet, punch in the answers to a few questions, and get quotes for the same value policies sold by many different.
Will they also be able to punch in their income and the size of their family and find out how much of the cost of their health insurance will be picked up by the federal or state government as a consequence of Obamacare?
Absolutely, and rates. Sure, rates are going to differ by family size. Obviously, if you buy insurance as an individual,
so that's all built into the rate. Then
that's right. There'll be separate rates for individuals and for families. And then, as you pointed out, yes, people who earn less than 400% of the poverty level will be subsidized, and that subsidy
would be about $75,000 a year, $80,000.
The average is about $5,000 a year, but the average varies greatly. If you're close to 400% of the poverty level, which for a family of four is about $90,000, if you're close to that, you'll get a very small subsidy. But then that subsidy increases as you get closer to 133% of the poverty level, and then below 133% of the poverty level. Again, this depends on whether the governors accept this, but the Affordable Care Act provides that Medicaid can be expanded for anyone up to 133% of the poverty level, but and in that case, people who make less than that will automatically qualify for Medicaid and will be able to enroll in Medicaid through the exchange.
And get basically free single-payer health insurance if you're making less than what is, would that be about in the neighborhood of $20,000 a year?
Well, that's exactly
basically
right.
Minimum wage.
Single-payer is a dirty word to some of our friends who are governors in these red states. So, listen, this is even more bizarre than the position that they've taken on the exchanges. For the Medicaid expansion, the federal government pays 100% of the cost for the first 3 years, and then thereafter, the states must pay a couple of percent, and then beginning in 2020, they pay 10%, but the federal government continues to pay 90%.
Right.
So over the long run, at very worst, the states get back $9 for each dollar that they put in. They get back $9 from the federal government. And for the first 3 years, it's 100% paid by the federal government.
And yet, still you have some Republican governors who are saying, ain't going to take the money.
That. We're not going to take the money.
Right.
We prefer to have our people uninsured.
Right.
Even
That's
though
bizarre.
The federal government will pay, we want our people to stay uninsured. And not only that, but we'll have our taxpayers in our state pay federal taxes to insure people in other states. So it's completely bizarre. And what makes it the most bizarre is the states that have the highest rate of uninsured, like Texas, for example, they're the ones who've been the most aggressive in saying they're not going to take the Medicaid money.
Yeah, this is all political posturing, and I have a feeling over the next couple of years it'll shake out, but we'll see. Jay Angoff, findjustice.com. Thank you, Jay.
Hey, thank you.
For illuminating us. I appreciate it. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Bizarre? Ironic? No, it's Republican. We'll be right back. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Very interesting stuff. Okay, I'm going to give you a little bit of Hamilton. And while we're trying to get Wendell Potter on the line here, I had a question that I wanted to ask about the Affordable Care Act that was actually provoked by a conversation over at DU over the weekend. We'll see. But anyhow, here 1792. Keep in mind, right now you've got Republicans saying, oh, our debt is so big. It's such a terrible. It's awful. We can't. Oh, it's unbelievable. It's going to destroy America. And in fact, we're not even going to be able to pay our bills. We're going to default. We got this debt ceiling coming up. We're going to let, you know, we're going to let the sequester go into effect. We're going to let the debt ceiling go. They're doing everything they can to destroy our nation, or at least our nation's credit rating, so that in the election next year, in which the fate of the Senate and the House will be determined, they are hoping that Americans will look at the terrible economy that the Republicans are working really, really hard to create, and they will blame Obama for it. So, 1792, Alexander Hamilton. Oh, actually, I'm going to get back to that at the bottom of the hour, because Wendell Potter is on the line with us. And boy, is that cool. WendellPotter.com, of course, is his website. He is the former healthcare industry insider turned whistleblower and the author of a book called Deadly Spin, a former vice president of one of the largest health insurance companies in the United States. Wendell Potter, welcome back to the program, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
So just a simple question, and I think I already know the answer to this, but I wanted to reality test it. Somebody over on the DU board over the weekend was asking the question, if the federal government can't negotiate Medicare drug prices, but the VA can negotiate drug prices, why doesn't Medicare just buy their drugs from the VA? Now, I'm assuming that the answer is because Medicare actually uses the retail distribution system. In other words, they, you know, my mother-in-law who's on Medicare goes down to the local pharmacy and picks up her drugs. And if it worked the way that was just described, she'd have to go to a Veterans Administration hospital to get them. And there's no mechanism for that. But let me just toss that to you as a wide open question. Is there some way around this Medicare Part D provision that is a $600 billion windfall for the pharmaceutical industry?
Well, it probably would require a legislative change to the prescription drug benefits that went into effect in 2006. The way that was structured, the drug companies and insurance companies really came out looking great. And as a result, the Medicare program was not given the ability to negotiate with drug companies. Instead, if you sign up for the Part D, which is the prescription drug benefit, you have to do that through an insurance company, which then it in turn does negotiating with the drug company. So there's no consistency from company to company. You might be paying more for one drug if you're in Cigna and less if you're in Aetna. But that's why. It was because of the crazy way that the drug benefit was structured.
So it was structured in a way that not only benefited the pharmaceutical industry, and I've heard this number, $600 billion over a decade. Is that a fairly accurate number?
That's right. It's a huge, huge amount of money.
Okay. So it not only benefits the pharmaceutical industry, but it's also benefiting the health insurance companies because the money's running through their hands and they're skimming a little bit of vig off the top?
You betcha. It's a big source of revenue and profits for insurance companies and for pharmaceutical companies. Keep in mind, the drug benefit was created during the Bush administration when there was a prevailing belief in the White House that the private sector could do much better than the public sector. But what we see as a consequence is that we're paying a ton more money for drugs than we need to.
Now, when somebody's on Medicaid, which is the health insurance, Medicare is for people over 65. Medicaid is for anybody. In fact, most of your child health programs in the various states. In Vermont, Howard Dean called ours Dr. Dinosaur when I lived there. These programs are actually Medicaid. Does Medicaid cover pharmaceuticals?
It does. It used to do it differently and in a more equitable way, in a way that saved the government and taxpayers money.
How?
Again, when the Medicare Part D program was passed, a lot of people who are in Medicaid are also on Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
They're called dual eligibles. So there's what the president most recently has suggested doing is trying to at least go back to the way it used to be when the federal government and the state governments would be able to negotiate with drug companies to get a better deal for the Medicaid population.
Right. So those Medicaid folks who are not dual eligibles, in other words, the 10-year-old who is the child of his parents who are, you know, in their 30s or 40s and working at McDonald's and, you know, making under the poverty line or working at Walmart or whatever, who's eligible for Medicaid. Those prices can be negotiated by the federal government. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
So,
with the states, the Medicaid program is administered by the states.
But they still pick up their drugs at the local Walmart or Walgreens or Rite Aid or locally owned pharmacy. Is that correct?
That's right.
So how does Walmart or Walgreens, how do they make their piece of the pie and the Medicaid? It doesn't diminish their profit, it just diminishes their wholesale price and thus the retail price?
Well, yeah, their profit margins might be a little slimmer, but they still make money on it. They still are able to make some money being the means of distribution of the medications. Of course, the drug makers make money as well, too, and then there's other layer of middlemen called a pharmacy benefit managers make some money as well, too. But it's a better proposition and cost taxpayers less than we see in the Medicare program.
And under the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, those states that have said, like Rick Perry in Texas, we're not going to take your damn Medicaid money, their people will not be eligible for those lower-priced government-negotiated pharmaceuticals.
That's right. That's exactly right.
It's amazing. Wendell Potter, thank you for illuminating us and clarifying these issues. It's great talking with you. WendellPotter.com, check out his site. And pick up a copy of his book, Deadly Spin. It's brilliant. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's President's Day, and I want to share with you what Alexander Hamilton told George Washington, echoes of John Boehner, right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, objections number 2 and 3. This is Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton, 1792, talking to George Washington as a member of the cabinet, as the Secretary of the Treasury, and saying, well, here's what people are saying, and here's my answer to them. So by objection, he's saying, here's what here's what, you know, the nannering nanobs of negativism, to channel Spiro Agnew, are saying. And I just find this so fascinating. It's like what goes around comes around, right? Objection number two. This accumulation of debt has taken forever out of our power those easy sources of revenue, which apply to the ordinary necessities and exigencies of government, would have animated them habitually and covered us from habitual murmurings against taxes and tax gatherers. Reserving extraordinary calls for extraordinary occasions would animate the people to meet them. Okay. In other words, he's saying basically that these people are saying that we've accumulated so much debt that everybody in the country is in up in arms about taxes and you know, the equivalent of the IRS, the tax collectors, and this is like, you know, this is a bad thing. Here's his answer. It's only two paragraphs. It's fairly straightforward. He says, answer, there having been no accumulation of debt, if what is here pretended to have been the consequences were true, it would only be to be regretted as the unavoidable consequence of an unfortunate state of things. But the supposed consequence does by no means exist. The only sources of taxation which have been touched, in other words, this is the only kind of tax we have, are imported articles, and the single internal object, in other words, the only thing we're taxing here in the United States within our borders, of distilled liquor, of distilled spirits. And semicolon, land, houses, the great mass of personal as well as the whole of real property remain essentially free. In short, the chief sources of taxation, in other words, the things that we can, if we ever need money, we can tax these other things. Right? He says, in short, the chief sources of taxation are free for extraordinary conjectures. In other words, you know, if we really get in a pinch, we can raise some serious taxes here. Because all we're taxing is basically, you know, tariffs on imported goods. And it is one of the distinguishing merits of the system which has been adopted that it has rendered this far more the case than it was before. It is only necessary to look into the different states to be convinced of that. Most of them, real estate is wholly exempted, and some very small burthens rest upon it. It is a mockery of truth. Now, I'm listen carefully to this one sentence. This is the end, the last sentence of the answer to objection two. Alexander Hamilton, 1792, letter to George Washington and the nation as a cabinet officer. Because there were all these guys running around going, oh, my God, look at all this debt we've got. We have a debt crisis in the United States. And Hamilton said, quote, it is a mockery of truth to represent the United States as a community burdened and exhausted by taxes. Actually, he said burthened, but the word has the same meaning. Okay, and then here's the third one, and this is the ultimate, you know, this is the objection. In other words, what the people who oppose the Washington administration, who oppose Hamilton, to some extent, actually, Jefferson, he was talking about, the people who oppose Hamilton, that the calls for money have been no greater than we must generally expect for the same or equivalent exigencies. Probably mispronouncing that word, aren't I? Exigencies. Yet we are already obliged to strain the impost till it produces clamor. In other words, we've raised taxes too much. And that will produce evasion and war on our citizens to collect it. And even to resort to an excise law of odious character with the people, partial in its operation, unproductive unless enforced by arbitrary and vexatious means, and committing the authority of the government in parts where resistance is the most probable and coercion least practicable. In other words, the people are going, these taxes are so terrible that people will evade them. We will have to declare war on our people to collect them. And we're doing it in ways that are not going to work. Here is Hamilton's answer to this objection that he laid forward. I read it to you verbatim. Answer. This is mere painting and exaggeration. Period. End of sentence. I'm telling you, it's like watching the Sunday shows. You know, it's like the Republican, oh, you know, taxes, oh, taxes are killing us. Oh, debt is killing us. This is mere painting and exaggeration. With the exception of a very few articles, the duties on imports are still moderate, lower than in any other country whose regulations we have knowledge of, except perhaps Holland, where having few productions of commodities of their own, their export trade, and he goes on about that. So, I just thought it was really interesting that Alexander Hamilton, and, you know, those of you who have listened to me for years and years, you know that in many regards, I've not been much of a fan of Alexander Hamilton, although my respect for him has been increasing radically over the last couple of years. But I actually trashed him in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? Because he was so aggressive in trashing Jefferson. And I was looking at this fight between the two of them. And as I said earlier, I think Hamilton really didn't understand small-d democracy. He didn't trust the people, which is why he wanted the president to be elected for life. And Jefferson absolutely understood democracy, but didn't understand economics. Whereas Hamilton was brilliant, probably one of the most brilliant people this country has ever produced when it came to economics. And George Washington, who was a really, really smart military man and a great leader, you know, the 6'5" commander, had three horses shot out from underneath him in the Revolutionary War. But when it came to both democracy and economics, was not the brightest bulb on the tree. He was no intellectual. George Washington didn't leave, you know, papers and letters and volumes for us to read and didn't. I mean, James Madison ghost wrote most of George Washington's speeches. So you just consider, you know, here's Washington, who was a great military leader, and he was president. And, you know, at that time, the main job of the president was being commander in chief of the military. And he had in his cabinet, in the area that dealt with democracies and foreign relations, the Secretary of State, he had Thomas Jefferson. And in the part that dealt with money, he had Alexander Hamilton. And it was like, can you believe it? I mean, it was almost like, it's enough to make you believe in divine providence. David in Portland, you wanted to add something to the Hamilton-Jefferson story.
Yeah, well, I think that... I love this story. I really, really love the story about Hamilton. And Hamilton was a conservative, but
arguably,
conservatives were different then.
Yes.
The thing about it was he was very responsible. He was into establishing again the full faith and credit of the United States, and he knew that the debt would be easily paid off because of the fact that he knew that the new country, the United States, had vast untapped wealth, and that paying off that debt would be inconsequential in the long term. And right. So he
said so.
Brushed it up. Yeah, the thing that's so interesting to me now is that you see, we're in the same position right now because the basis of our economy now, our essential resource is energy. Hmm. And there's more solar energy hitting the United States right now. I mean, we have the best solar resources in the entire world, other than the Middle East or Central America.
Arguably, Australia is doing pretty well, too. But yeah, and wind as well. We can easily generate more than enough electricity to power our entire nation and even export it massively.
Just the state of Arizona could power the whole entire nation.
Yeah.
Just the solar energy hitting Arizona. So we're sitting amidst the most vast wealth that would blow the national debt away in seconds, really. It's really, people have to solarize. They've got to get solar.
Yep.
I don't work for the industry, but I just know that is going to be the key to our recovery, is getting everybody going and transforming our economy.
I would add to that, if we were to also go back to a Hamiltonian trade perspective, so that those solar panels are being manufactured here in the United States rather than in some low-wage country, and that companies that do business outside the United States are still having, you know, if they're calling themselves American companies, they're having to, you know, pay American taxes, and there's this big push to not do that now.
That's right.
that you know, we could put it all back together. And you're right. Hamilton, you know, Hamilton fiercely, now the difference between Hamilton and Jefferson that made Hamilton arguably conservative was Hamilton was not afraid of rich people. In fact, he thought they would always operate ultimately in the interest of the nation. Jefferson was very wary of rich people. He said, it is the people, not the rich, to whom I would confer my, you know, the fate and future of my nation. And he said, I do not look to the rich as our salvation, as our national salvation. Hamilton, on the other hand, thought the rich were kind of cool. He wanted to be one of them. And that was, I think, one of the major differentiators between these two men. David, thank you for the call. And thanks for the insight, the commentary. We'll be back. It's 45 minutes past it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Happy George Washington's birthday, a.k.a. President's Day. So let's dig into American history. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Gene in Denver, Colorado, says, you want to disagree with me about Hamilton? Really?
But not as much. I'm just not entirely sure about its applicability to the current state of affairs of the current administration.
Okay.
Because there's two things that I'd like to, that I kind of latched onto that made me believe that this is a false equivalency. First, like the tone of the letter that you cited with Hamilton is, it belies the underlying assumption that it is in our best interest to pay off the debt. He's simply arguing with the people who say it can't be done, that it's going to be a disaster.
You're right.
And
you're right.
And second issue is that he's saying that it's also as a result of a one-time event, the war, whereas what's going on nowadays, it's a result of policies that are, you know, pushing or policies that continue to be ongoing under the present administration. And quite frankly, I don't see that either political party is interested in stopping those.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you on that.
So,
but I think that the there's obviously always, when you're making a historical parallel, particularly one that's 240 years old, 230 years old, that and change, there's going to be false equivalencies, certainly. But the fact of the matter is that we have not been without a debt since then. It just kept rolling over and rolling over. That the major message that Hamilton was trying to deliver, and the major battle that he fought in the cabinet in the administration in 1792, was whether or not we would make good on the war debt from the Revolutionary War, whether we would pay it at par or whether we would pay it at something less than par. Because those Revolutionary War notes, they were called Continentals. I mean, you know, they, as good as a Continental means worthless, right? I mean, and they were being traded at
the Whiskey Rebellion.
Well, that was a slightly different thing. I mean, the Whiskey Rebellion was actually a wholly different thing. But and I want to wander off into that territory right now. But and Washington put that down, and that was arguably the first serious assertion of federal power by a federalist government, and among people who thought basically, and they were probably the old anti-federalists, they were probably people who thought that the Constitution never should have been ratified, and they wanted to continue operating under the Articles of Confederacy, and they didn't respect the federal government's right to tax them, and George Washington said no, not the case, and he rode in with, well, he didn't actually ride into the battle itself, but he got close to it. But pulled together a bunch of militia and they put it down. And the same thing with Shays' Rebellion. But the point is that Hamilton was saying that the currency that this country has is the full faith and confidence, the trust of other people, other nations and individuals within our country, that we will pay our debts. And if that faith is shaken, that will damage our nation. And so the equivalency that I am drawing, and I don't think this is a false equivalency, is what Hamilton was saying back in his time was, please stop the chatter that our country, and it was being said by people like Thomas Jefferson. So, I mean, you know, he had a serious and loud enemy who was also in the cabinet. He says, please stop the chatter that we're not going to pay our debt back at par. In other words, we're not going to pay back a dollar with a dollar. That we're going to pay back a dollar with 50 cents. He says, stop saying that, because that, or that we might pay back a dollar, not at all. He said, stop saying that, because that is going to rattle the markets. That's going to rattle people, and they will then demand a higher interest rate, and we will then go further in debt because we're going to have to pay more to service our debt. We may not even be able to borrow anymore. And the modern day equivalent of that is Barack Obama just a couple of months ago saying to the Republicans, please stop talking about the debt ceiling because you are shaking the confidence of investors around the world in U.S. treasuries. And that is not a good thing for America. They were saying essentially the exact same things.
And that's actually a point we're in agreement on is, actually, there's another like name that I've actually been following that's been helpful for me to get educated on this. If you're familiar with the name of Martin Armstrong, the chairman of Princeton Economics.
I'm not.
He's saying basically the same thing, that like the reason that the debt is a problem is significantly that confidence is the problem in both the debt and the there's a widespread perception internationally that America's courts are corrupt with respect to Wall Street is vastly undermining confidence in America and hurting the willingness of other countries to do business with us.
I agree. And the major problem that we have with our debt is that it's being used as a political weapon by the Republicans against a Democratic president, which it was never used as a political weapon when Democrats had control and you had a Republican presence. In fact, it had never been used as a weapon all the way back, with the single exception of 1792, when Hamilton fought back against Jefferson and Madison in this case. Jefferson and Madison playing the role of John Boehner, and I find it painful to say. And with the single exception of 1792, our debt has never been used as a political weapon of one party to bash another party. And back in 1792, you know, Hamilton was the Federalist, as was Washington, and Jefferson and Madison were conspiring to create the Democratic Republican Party at that time, you know, out of the remnants of the Anti-Federalists. And so it's like, you know, we should take a lesson from this. I think that there's, you know, there is something very serious here that we should note. Gene, I got to run. Thank you very much for the call. Dan in Chicago. Dan, we have just a minute to the top of the hour. You wanted to make a quick comment on the whiskey tax.
Yeah, quick comment. It was also the start of the unfairness of taxes because Washington was a big landholder who grew rye. And many of the people in the cabinet were, and they exempted themselves from the whiskey tax, and that's why there was the whiskey rebellion. And that came from a wonderful book by David Bloom.
But they weren't distilling it. They were supplying the raw materials.
They were supplying the raw, but they were also involved in the chain of selling it, as I understand it. And the farmers were growing it. They were distilling it because it was clean water, for one thing, right. And it was fuel for the farm. And as David Bloom has now pointed out, when you were the one who recommended the book that mm-hmm. I love. It's on the first page of the recommendations. Mm-hmm. And he was the one who says that would be our energy source today if we could just grow it and use it. There's enough to
it. Yeah, he's right. And in fact, I mean, you go back and you look that you know, some of the very first cars made were running either on hemp oil or on ethanol or methanol. Dan, thanks a lot for the call. I think it's an interesting point.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Julia Trigg Crawford is on the line with us. Julia Trigg is the third generation to manage her family's 650-acre farm down in Texas. She's also a former star basketball player for Texas A&M and Governor Perry's alma mater. Isn't that ironic? Citizen.org, the website she would refer you to. Julia Trigg Crawford, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate you having me.
Thank you for joining us. I understand that TransCanada wanted to take some of your land by easement under the Fifth Amendment, eminent domain, to takings. And have they pulled this off, first of all?
Well, they haven't crossed my land yet, but they are moving as fast as they can to take land and build the pipeline on my neighbor's properties. We are one of the few families who decided to stand up and fight, not because we had a whole lot of money to fight it, but because our Texas principles of don't mess with Texas run pretty deep in our family.
Okay. And in fighting back, you went to court, and the local law judge issued a ruling that was 15 words long on his iPhone. Do I have that right?
That's right. After months of courtroom hearings and testimony and thousands of pages of documents, international coverage from some of the big news agencies, the judge, after sitting on or making his decision over the course of 10 days after the hearing, sent his ruling from the iPhone and blind copied the press, so they were actually the first ones to call me.
Wow. And his ruling was that it was
perfectly... was that TransCanada's motion for summary judgment was granted, and they had the right to take my land or a piece of our farm for the pipeline. We've since asked for a little bit more, you know, information. You know, 15 words from his iPhone doesn't tell us what statutes he used and, you know, how difficult the decision was and kind of what he weighed. So he said he's under no obligation legally to provide us any more information or clarity. So,
which is true.
More reason to take it up the food chain to the appeals court.
Right. So you're taking this to the Sixth Circuit Court. Do I have that right?
Yes,
federal court.
It's state court.
Oh, state court. Okay.
Texas. And I mean, the next step after that would be the Texas Supreme Court. And as long as my legal defense fund that people are contributing to, as long as it holds out, we'll stand our ground.
And where's your legal defense fund on the internet? How do people find that, Julia?
Well, I have a website, standwithjulia.com, and there you can see how beautiful the farm is and how proud our family is standing there. And you know, some people hold bake sales and car washes to raise money. We've been lucky to have people contribute to the defense fund, and I'm even holding a big concert on April the 20th at our farm. We just decided, so I hope to rock Lamar County with an educational benefit concert and awareness on April the 20th.
That is wonderful. Standwithjulia.com, right?
Yes.
Okay. And are you in Washington, D.C., or are you participating?
I am. I'm calling you from you're calling me at the National Museum of the American Indian. I was here for the rally. That was the most amazing thing, because for so long, Tom, it was like the Crawford family against the world. You know, the Crawford family against TransCanada. And I came in 2011. I was arrested as part of that 1,200 people in front of the White House. I've been back for two other rallies, but yesterday drove it home to me that our fight for our land is part of a bigger fight for our planet.
We're talking with Julia Trigg Crawford. Standwithjulia.com is the website. She's fighting TransCanada's attempt to take a piece of her property to build a pipeline across Texas. And Julia Trigg, what was it like to take on a transnational corporation?
Well, you know, it's almost like if I had known what this was going to be like, I would have been more prepared. At first, you know, I'm a very competitive person, and like you said, and thank you for doing your research. You know, I like a good fight, and when you're standing on a principle, it's not hard to take on anybody. I'll take on anybody who wanted to, you know, I came on as a steward of this land to do whatever I could, whether it was, you know, a foreign corporation or a domestic corporation. But when you kind of drilled it away that there's a foreign corporation that's a for-profit endeavor, who feels like they have the right, they have more of a right to my land than I do, it was easy to stand up. There have been days that are just crazy, because it's my family and one attorney against an army representing a company with millions or billions at stake. And as it stands right now, because we're in court, TransCanada has the right to start digging, but they haven't. The pipeline is in the ground and ready to go at both of my neighbor's properties, but there's a 1,200-foot strip across mine that's just sitting there.
And this is because, you know.
You know, I think it's because TransCanada knows it all. There's a lot of eyes on that. And should we prevail, and we believe we will, at the appellate court, if they have already started construction, there could be some penalties assessed. So
right.
I haven't asked them why they haven't started digging. They told me they were going to start construction on my place in the middle of November, but there's been no one on it yet.
Fascinating. And standwithjulia.com, check out this website, standwithjulia.com. Julia Trigg Crawford on the line with us, fighting back against TransCanada. Julia, is there anything you'd like to add to this, or any message that you want our listeners to hear to carry home beyond what we've talked about?
Yesterday was an incredible day, and while it was about overall climate change, you know, the first this first dragon we have to slay is Keystone XL. I think what people don't realize is even though the president denied the first attempt for Keystone to get their permit across the border, when that was denied last year, TransCanada basically uncoupled the southern leg, and they can't build it fast enough. So the pipeline that's already being built in Texas is basically part of Keystone XL, but TransCanada found a way to rename it and reformat it. So it's not like there's no Keystone being built. It's being built right now in Texas with workers going 6 days a week, is, you know, daylight to dark.
Wow. So, with Rick Perry's help.
Oh, yes.
Whatever happened to states' rights? Why is Rick Perry gung-ho on this? Is it because the refineries down there are going to make a pile of money for the state? And
I think there's all kinds of rhetoric about jobs and money, but... there have been, at our very first day of our hearing, the governor and two senators, there were letters presented to the court on their behalf on how wonderful this pipeline is. I'd like to know what Governor Perry would have done if this company was taking the land in his backyard, threatening his water. I mean, this pipeline is to go under the creek where I irrigate my farm and through a pasture that's full of Caddo Indian artifacts. I mean, I'm fighting for water, land, and indigenous artifacts. That's a perfect storm right there.
Yeah, it is. Well, Julia Trigg, I wish you the very best.
Thank you, Tom.
And thanks for being on our program. Julia Trigg Crawford, standwithjulia.com, and, of course, citizen.org, public citizen. Great talking with you. A genuine patriot, a real hero. This is a wonderful and remarkable thing. So back to Alexander Hamilton, very quickly. To the point of just very, very, very quickly. This is how personal this got. You know, like right now, you hear about John Boehner taking personally what the president has to say or whatever. Mr. Jefferson with very. This is his letter to Mr. Carrington. Mr. Jefferson, with very little reserve, manifests his dislike of the funding system generally. He's talking about, you know, whether or not they should pay the debt. Calling in question the expediency of funding a debt at all. Some expressions which he has dropped in my presence, sometimes without sufficient attention to delicacy, will not permit me to doubt on this point. Representations which I have heard from respectable quarters. In other words, respectable people he's trashing, not just him to his face. He says, in various conversations with foreigners as well as citizens, he has thrown censure on my principles of government and on my measures of administration. He did it in a style and manner which I felt was partaking of asperity and ill humor toward me. When any turn of things in the community has threatened either odium or embarrassment to me, Mr. Jefferson has not been able to suppress the satisfaction which it gave him. Now tell me these guys... It's like, yeah, they're human beings. He's, I gotta share this with about Madison and Jefferson, and then I'll pick up your calls. We'll continue this conversation.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Is history repeating itself literally from the George Washington administration today with regard to our national debt on President's Day? Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. When do you know when that was, or how it was? So maybe I was wrong. I was just arguing with a fellow on Free Speech TV who said that Obama said that George Bush running up the debt was unpatriotic and un-American, and I said you will never find President Obama calling another politician unpatriotic or un-American. And then Shano tracked down the soundbite, and no, he wasn't. Well, hear it. Just let us hear it.
In the name of our children, driving up our national debt from $5 trillion for the first 42 presidents, number 43 added $4 trillion by his lonesome, so that we now have over $9 trillion of debt that we are going to have to pay back. $30,000 for every man, woman, and child. That's irresponsible. It's unpatriotic.
Okay. All right. I stand corrected, because that is essentially calling the president unpatriotic. I stand corrected. And thank you for calling and sharing that with us. In any case, Obama shouldn't have engaged in debt mongering. And I don't think any politician should be, frankly. But beyond that, the big thing here is using the debt as a tool to threatening to default on the debt. That's the really scary thing. And Republicans are using this debt ceiling law that they themselves got passed back in the 19-teens to try to prevent us from going into World War I, which in retrospect was, I don't know if it was laudable or not, but in any case, I still have not figured out World War I. Republicans are using the threat of default as a political tool, and that is problematic. And that threat of default is something that could do considerable harm to the United States, and that's what Hamilton was talking about in 1792, was that threat of default. So, you know, trashing other politicians, and even trashing them around the debt is nothing new. In fact, here's Alexander Hamilton trashing Thomas Jefferson about their disagreement over whether or not the debt should be paid at par. In other words, the debt should be paid off. He said these... He goes through this long rant about, you know, the creditor, this paper, this kind of conduct has appeared to me the more extraordinary on the part of Mr. Madison, as I know for certainty it was a primary article of his creed that the real danger with our system was the subversion of the national authority by the preponderance of the state governments. In other words, he says, you know, Madison was a Federalist. And then he goes on, in respect to foreign policies, politics, this is where he's getting really nasty. In respect to foreign politics, the views of these gentlemen are, in my judgment, equally unsound and dangerous. They have a womanish attachment to France and a womanish resentment against Great Britain. They would draw us into the closest embrace of the former and involve us in all the consequences of our politics, and they would risk the peace of the country in their endeavors to keep us the greatest possible distance from the latter. Now, again, this was basically what was at the core of this fight between Jefferson and Hamilton was that much of the debt of the United States was held by people who had fought in the Revolutionary War, sold supplies to the government for the Revolutionary War. It was a script, a form of script, you know, basically what today you'd call a treasury note or a bond, treasury bill. Except nobody knew if the government would pay it off or not. And so these speculators had come in and they had said to these Revolutionary War patriots, they had said, hey, you're sitting on $100 worth of debt, but, you know, the government may never make good on it. So I'll buy it from you for $20. And a lot of people sold it for $10, $20, $30. You know, I mean, it was $5, $50. And an enormous amount of this government debt had accumulated in the hands of wealthy speculators in New York. And these guys, these banksters in New York, they were friends of Alexander Hamilton's. He saw them as, you know, the people who would help build a great country. Jefferson hated those people. He basically wanted them to get screwed. He was like, you know, don't pay back the damn debt. And Madison was trying to thread the needle. He was trying to walk through the middle. And so he came up with two different plans. One was to totally screw the speculators and basically pay back the original holders of the debt at full value. So it would cost the government the full value of the debt. And the other was to pay the speculators only for the profit that they made. In other words, if a speculator bought $100 worth of debt for $30, the speculator had $70 worth of profit on a $30 investment, right? If it sold for, if it was $100 worth of debt, it was paid back at $100. So Madison's second plan was to say, okay, instead of giving that speculator $100 for a $100 note, give them $70 and take the $30 and track down the patriot who sold him that note and give him his $30 back. Or give him an additional $30. And again, it would equal 100%. And Hamilton's suggestion was Just give the damn speculators their money. In some cases, it's not going to be the speculators. Some of the patriots, the original people who fought the Revolutionary War, were still holding on to the debt. And they would make $100 on a $100 note. But most of it at that point was in the hands of speculators. And Hamilton was like, so what? And this got so personal. He's Mr. Jefferson. In France, he saw the government only on the side of its abuses. He drank freely of the French philosophy and religion and science and politics. He came from France in the moment of a fermentation, which he had a share in exciting. He's talking about the French Revolution. And he came here with probably too partial an idea of his own powers. And then he says, Mr. Madison had always entertained an exalted opinion of the talents, knowledge, and virtues of Mr. Jefferson. The sentiment was probably reciprocal. A close correspondence subsisted between the time of Mr. Jefferson's absence from the country. A close intimacy arose upon his return. Mr. Jefferson was indiscreetly open in his approbation.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I say indiscreetly because a gentleman in the administration in one department ought not to have taken sides against another in another department. Oh, the horrors. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very catechetically ugly, the good. David Peck. Peck is one of several farmers in upstate New York to install solar panels to help lower the cost of maintaining his farm. Despite costing $100,000 to install, Peck thinks that he's already saved at least $10,000 in energy costs in the past year. Here he is talking about his energy and cost efficiency investment.
Well, it's saved a significant amount of money for electricity. I think in the long run, it'll make it help us be stay in business and make us more competitive.
So, solar power is clean, energy efficient, and it keeps more money in your wallet compared to traditional forms of energy. It's time for the federal government to make switching to renewable sources of energy like solar power a national priority. The bad. Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn. Appearing on C-SPAN's Washington Journal on Friday, Blackburn shot down President Obama's State of the Union proposal for universal preschool education. Here's what she had to say.
I think so many of our educators, when they hear these programs coming from the federal government, they're just thinking, oh, that's another book of paperwork that I'm going to have to do. And teachers are so weighed down with that.
Apparently, in the eyes of Congresswoman Blackburn, improving our children's education system isn't worth a few extra minutes of paperwork. Pretty sure most teachers in this country don't share the Congresswoman's beliefs. And the very, very ugly Senator Lindsey Graham. Appearing on Fox News Sunday yesterday, the Republican stalwart told Chris Wallace that in order to avoid the looming sequester budget cuts that would destroy the military, we should eliminate health care to 30 million Americans. First, Graham got it all wrong. According to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, Obamacare actually reduces the federal deficit. And by eliminating it, as Graham is suggesting, our deficit would increase by a whopping $109 billion over a 10-year period. But more importantly, Graham would rather give more money to the military-industrial complex, which doesn't need it, than make sure Americans have access to the health care they need to survive. And that is very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Okay, just to wrap this up. Jefferson and Madison, but Jefferson in particular, hated the speculators, the bankers in New York. And Hamilton had been the representative from New York to the Constitutional Convention and loved the bankers. Hamilton was had an interesting personality. He was an illegitimate child. He was born in the Bahamas. He was apparently a rather short man not that being short is good or bad or anything, but in Hamilton's case, apparently he was quite conscious of it and spent much of his life basically sucking up to power. And Mr. Jefferson didn't think so well of that. Actually, Madison might have even been shorter than Hamilton. But in any case, in fact, Madison was just this wispy little, he probably weighed 110 pounds. He was just a very, very thin, small man. So anyhow, here's Hamilton. He says, Mr. Jefferson was indiscreetly open in his approbation of Mr. Madison's principles upon his first coming to the seat of government. I say indiscreetly because a gentleman in the administration in one department ought not to have taken sides against another in another department. The course of this business begot some degree of ill humor in Mr. Jefferson. These causes, and perhaps some others, created much sooner than I was aware of it, a systematic opposition to me on the part of these gentlemen. My subversion, I am now satisfied, has been long an object with them. Subsequent events have increased the spirit of opposition and the feelings of personal mortification on the part of these gentlemen. A mighty stand was made on the affair of the bank. There was much commitment in the case. I prevailed. On the mint business, I was opposed from the same quarters and with still less success. In the affairs of ways and means for the Western Expedition, on the supplementary arrangements concerning the debt, except as to the additional assumption, my views have been equally prevalent in opposition to theirs. This is Hamilton just kind of bragging on it. You know, hey, I just kicked these guys' butts all over the place, and this is what... The current of success on one side and of defeat on the other has rendered the opposition furious, that would be Jefferson and Madison, and has produced a disposition to subvert their competitors, that would be me, Hamilton, even at the expense of the government. And then, the really bad stuff. Jefferson wants to run for president. Another circumstance has contributed to widening the breach. It is evident beyond a question from every movement that Mr. Jefferson aims with ardent desire at the presidential chair. Ah, he's got him figured out. He was right, by the way. That was 1792. That was the first year, first full year of the George Washington administration. And Hamilton got a heck of a lot of stuff done. And the main thing that he got done was making sure that the full faith and credit of the United States government would never be questioned because we paid off those Civil War debts at par, even to the point of making the speculators in New York rich, which didn't hurt Hamilton's political ambitions at all because they were his patrons. So anyway. So it's just I just find the whole thing fascinating. Alan in Crown Point, Indiana. Hey, Alan, what's
yes,
up?
Yes, hi, Tom. I wanted to make a couple, and I think this may be something you really don't have any control over, but I would like to hear your comment on it about printing money. You know, printing a lot of money. Obviously, it's going to have an effect on a value. But one of your sponsors, and I think this is a
sir, is yeah, Alan. I'm sorry. I just many of our stations carry, we have different, there are different sponsors carried on different stations in different ways. And I just, you know, and our nonprofit stations don't hear any sponsors. And I'm just not going to get into a conversation about whoever it is you're talking about and whether it's a local company or I just have no idea. And it ain't going to happen. George in, I'd like to keep the helicopter view here. Let's stay at 30,000 feet. George in Keyport, New Jersey. Hey, George. Thanks for listening to WWRL. What's up?
How you doing, Tom? I'm just calling in reference to your guest, Julia, that started the hour.
Yeah.
We had a similar situation here in New Jersey where there was some long-term residents in houses along the waterfront, and the town and a wealthy developer tried to buy up their land, and that didn't work. They tried to... condemn their property and take it by eminent domain, and they actually went through the full court procedure.
Mm-hmm.
They actually won, and they beat back the town and the wealthy developer. So I just wanted to tell Julia to keep up the fight for her own property and don't let anybody take it from her.
Yeah, I mean, the big problem is the Kelo decision, the Kelo versus New London, where and David Souter was, I believe, the deciding vote in this, or if not, he was certainly on the side of the city of New London and saying that they could take private property from a private homeowner and give that private property to a for-profit private corporation because it was ultimately in the to the benefit of the community because that new corporation would pay more in taxes than the individual homeowner had, And that was an interpretation of the Fifth Amendment Takings Clause, which had never been used before. It had always been, everybody agreed, hey, you know, if you need my land to build a road, fine. If you need my land to build a, you know, to run a power line through, I may not like it, but I understand the need for that, particularly if it's a public utility. If you need my land to build a public school, okay, you know, you got to have a school someplace. But taking my land to build a hotel, to make money for a hotel developer, that's wrong. But in the Kelo versus City of New London decision, the Supreme Court actually ruled that, yes, it's perfectly fine to take land from one individual, arguably a for-profit entity, a person, and give it to another, to a for-profit corporation, because it's going to jack up the tax rates. So your local person who won, must have had a hell of a strong case to win in the face of that Kelo decision. And Julia Trigg Crawford is facing a real battle. And, you know, because of this Kelo decision, I mean, this is why all those people went to New Hampshire and tried to, they created a small corporation and said, we are going to turn David Souter's home, former Supreme Court Justice, David Souter's home into a national landmark, a national monument, and we're a for-profit corporation. And they tried to take his home by eminent domain, and they didn't succeed ultimately. But this was in you know, revenge for that. So standwithjulia.com is where you can learn about that. But George, thanks for the tip on that. I appreciate it. Warren in Kirkland, Washington. Warren, just a minute to the break. A quick one on Smedley Butler.
Yes, I was just going to say today's the 10th anniversary for Vice President Cheney going to the VFW to drum the war drum up to about weapons of mass destruction. And I was just having to read this weekend, I was reading the story about General Smedley Butler and how the Wall Street banksters back then were getting him, because he was so well regarded with the VFW,
yep,
to basically to overthrow FDR. So
yeah.
I just wanted to get some presidential.
Well, it wasn't the VFW. It was another veterans organization, which I've forgotten the name of. It's not a large organization anymore.
The Foreign Wars.
Oh, it was the Veterans of Foreign Wars. You sure of that?
Yes, it was. Yeah,
okay.
I just read it yesterday. So.
Okay, I will believe
it. My mind.
It may well. Okay, but in any case, yeah, you're right. And Butler said, you know, it was the banksters, and he pointed out that he had been basically doing that he was an enforcer for the banksters all the way back to his time in the Spanish-American War, and he wasn't having any more of it anymore, and he blew the whistle. So. Interesting. 10th anniversary. Rachel Maddow tonight on her program on MSNBC is on that 10th anniversary of Cheney beating the war drums is going to be talking about that. It's going to be an interesting show.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I don't normally promote, you know, other for-profit programs, but we'll see. We'll find out. 45 minutes past it. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you 10 minutes before the hour, and Rick in Sac City, Iowa. Hey, Rick, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yeah, one of your previous callers said he didn't see what Hamilton Jefferson had to do with the current administration.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, don't you have to govern to be considered an administration?
Yeah.
And I don't think we've had anybody governing been going on for about 18 months.
Well, it's been a tough ride since the Republicans took control of the House of Representatives, and that's been more than 2 years. It's been and they've been filibustering in the Senate. In fact, really, it was the first 2 months and 1 day, as I recall, of the Obama administration until Scott Brown was sworn in Massachusetts after Teddy Kennedy died. That it was just a couple of months where Obama had a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate and Nancy Pelosi running the House of Representatives. And he got an awful lot done during that period of time. And, I've gone through the list before of the things that were accomplished. But then the Republicans just put the screaming brakes on. But, you know, yeah, I got your point, and it's a good one. Mike in Schererville, Indiana. Hey, Mike, what's up? Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio.
Thank you. I want to commend you on your integrity for being man enough to admit when you're wrong, but I don't think you were wrong. I believe I believe President Obama said that the act of what President Bush did was unpatriotic. He didn't say the man. And if you listen to Michelle Bachmann or something like that, you'd have to go back. I'd have to go back to the tape on that also. But
right.
I believe they correctly called the man unpatriotic.
Right. And so, in other words, this was. Do you want to play the first little bit of that, Shana? Would you? You'd have to find it again. All right, that's all right. Although it's it may be a difference without a distinction or the other way around. But I you're probably right. I mean, that was why I pushed back against that caller in saying, you know, the president would not call, even when, as a senator, would not call a president or another senator unpatriotic because it's just not done. But then confronted with the audio, well, here it is.
Over $9 trillion of debt that we are going to have to pay back. $30,000 for every man, woman, and child. That's irresponsible. It's unpatriotic.
Okay, so he's referring to the debt, not to the... but you know, I in either case, I think, you know, I agree with Alexander Hamilton in his... where did it go? Here it is, right here. In his Hamilton to Washington 1 cabinet paper, where he said, objection 3, that the calls for money will produce evasion and war on our citizens to collect it. He said this is mere painting and exaggeration. Or objection 2, this accumulation of debt has taken forever out of our power, those easy resources of revenue. And he said the only sources of he said this is a mockery of the truth to represent the United States as a community burdened and exhausted by taxes. And we had a caller earlier. And, Mike, thank you for the call. Thanks for the point that you made. We had a caller earlier who said, so we've got this debt and we're sitting on. And at the time, you know, Hamilton realized that this was a nation sitting on vast riches and resources. Stolen from the Indians, but still vast resources and riches and vast intellectual resources and riches as well. And, you know, Hamilton got that. And Washington got that. And Jefferson and Madison, they were more like, you know, we got these plantations and we got these slaves and let's just kind of keep growing cotton and be a rural and agrarian economy, at least until Jefferson became president. Then he picked up Hamilton's policies. But, you know, in the Washington cabinet, they were far more, they were actually opposed to that. And, you know, the debt, hey, you know, it's you're going to have to tax people for this debt and all this kind of stuff. So it was an interesting time. Anyhow, it's President's Day, and so I wanted to bring out this stuff about the first. It's actually George Washington's birthday, right? That's I don't know if today is actually literally his birthday, but this is the day on which traditionally his birthday was celebrated, and then it kind of got rolled into, and then we had Lincoln's birthday, and then we had somebody else's birthday. And they all got rolled together into President's Day. So I wanted to share with you some of my favorite stories out of the George Washington administration. And I think the highlight for me, I mean, there's some pretty amazing stuff that happened during the George Washington administration. But the highlight for me was this spitting war, shall we say, to clean it up slightly, between Hamilton on the one hand and Jefferson and Madison on the other. And Jim, your mic is open. Tom in Higginsville, Missouri. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I got a question for you here.
Sure.
Harry Reid, is he going to take another crack at the filibuster process?
Probably not, and it probably wouldn't do much good anyway because the Republicans control the House of Representatives. The one hope for this whole thing, and this is where maybe Harry Reid was actually smart. You know, I could build a case that Harry Reid did the right thing. Because blowing up the filibuster still wouldn't help if you don't have decent legislation coming out of the House, which is not going to happen. So if 2 years from now we have a national election and the Democrats take control of the House of Representatives and the Democrats hold control of the Senate, that would be a very smart time for Harry Reid or whoever becomes the leader of the senators to blow up the filibuster. But right now, I don't think that he would gain that much from doing it, frankly. My personal opinion. As much as I wanted him to do it and as strongly as I argued for it and kicked him upside the head for not doing it, looking back on it in retrospect, what are you going to get out of the House to not be filibuster? I mean, it has a lot to do with the appointments. It has a lot to do with making the president look bad. But I think that that's starting to backfire on the Republicans. I mean, once they got called out on this filibuster of Chuck Hagel, They're all running around going, it's not a filibuster. We're going to vote for him. Don't worry. Just wait. We'll be back next week. So, coming up tomorrow, we'll have a latest on the sequester, what it means, plus keeping you up to speed on what else is happening in the Congress that is not in session right now. And more on modern monetary theory and why you need to know about it. I'm going to continue my conversation with Australian economist Professor Steve Keen. So, and don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.